Good afternoon. I'm Savannah Bailey McLean, and I'm your host for State of the Arts. Our first guest today is Adam Foreman, who's the author of the study Creative New York that was produced by the Center for an Urban Future. So, Adam, let's just dive into it right now. You say in your study that the arts matter in New York City, but can you tell me in what ways?
Yeah, it's tremendously important to New York City. It's 7% of the jobs in New York City are in the arts or in the creative sector, as we defined it. It's also just so important for ensuring the vibrancy of New York City, attracting new talent to New York, keeping New York City an exciting, interesting place for young, talented people, and also just for making living here so fantastic. Providing the arts and the culture makes every day of my life more exciting and every day of every other New Yorker's life.
Great. But when you were doing your study, one of the things that I noticed was when you were examining the different professions that make up that industry, you were very conservative, you said, and you only chose 25 careers. Could you explain to us why you just did that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of different definitions of the so-called creative sector. Mm-hmm. Over the last decade, two decades, it was really sparked by the research of a Richard Florida, mm-hmm. Who looked at the creative class as a way, as kind of a vibrant, information-oriented professionals within an economy who both help are entrepreneurial and also attract talent to cities. His definition is more expansive than ours. It includes nurses and technologists, pretty broad. Ours was tried to be narrower. So we included people who are involved in the arts. It includes performing arts, visual arts, advertising, design, film. So it's still a wide berth, but we thought it was important that it's an ecosystem where lots of people are employed across very different sectors. So in advertising, for instance, you have filmmakers and photographers, graphic designers. So an ecosystem where there's a lot of cross-pollination.
Okay, so that explains that. That's pretty good. So one of the things I also noticed about the study, you interviewed 150 people.
Mm-hmm, including yourself?
Yes, I know. I was about to say that. And everyone touched on affordability. So I wanted you to tell us your assessment about the situation of affordability in New York City.
Yeah, it's such an important issue. And it's something that I would say all the 150 people brought up. So New York City's creative sector is growing. There's been 13% growth in jobs over the last decade, which is tremendous. But there are real threats on the horizon, and affordability is the major one. You know, whether it's workspace, living space, office space, it's very difficult to afford being an artist in New York, especially when salaries in a lot of these industries aren't very high. New York City is extremely expensive, and even Brooklyn, once an affordable haven, is not affordable by any means. It's the third most expensive county now in the country. It's 300% more expensive than Nashville, another creative hub. So this is a real challenge. And if we're not going to address these affordability challenges, people can't afford to stay here, and young professionals, young creatives won't come here.
So I know you believe that the new administration, de Blasio, is going to help remedy some of these issues, particularly the affordability of housing. But those of us who are kind of familiar with how things are done in New York City with public government knows that that takes a very, very long time. So do you really see in the short term that this is going to actually fix itself to some degree? And then I also want to talk about commercial spaces, because before that wasn't a big issue. But now commercial spaces, rehearsal spaces, exhibition spaces are now just as unaffordable as living. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to find out from you what your take is on what the de Blasio administration is trying to do.
Yeah, a lot of de Blasio administration's actions are encouraging. He promised 1,500 units of affordable housing for artists. He's also continuing a program called Spaceworks that was started under the Bloomberg administration to create affordable rehearsal space in city property, in libraries, and also other property. So we really encouraged the Blasio administration to continue programs like Spacework and his affordability, affordable housing initiatives, which we think are so critical. And we talked about a lot of other space that might be available, whether it's in park recreation centers or community centers at New York City Public Housing Authority or schools. You know, there's 1,200 schools across the city, and a lot of people leave those buildings after 4 p.m. Let's open up those art spaces, those performing art spaces, to actors, to dancers, to painters. So there is a lot of space in New York City that's available, but coordinating it and making it available is really critical. And we're encouraged by the progress thus far. But there has to be kind of two sides to the solution. So one is addressing that affordability issue. And New York City is never going to be as affordable as Nashville, never going to be as affordable as Detroit or Portland for that matter. So it has to come on the end of affordability, what we can do, but also making it more lucrative to be an artist in New York City so that you can afford that premium of being here. So we found that New York creatives actually get paid 45% more than national average. But when you adjust for cost of living, it becomes 12% less. So that gap, we need to change that gap, you know, make it even greater premium of being in New York. Some initiatives we talked about were exporting initiatives. So New York City artists and creatives are very intent on selling and producing their products abroad, whether it's dancers and theater companies traveling, or design, furniture makers selling abroad, fashion, anistas creating stores abroad, architects are getting an increasing amount of commissions abroad. So there's definitely this this ferment, but we need to make sure it's extended not just to the biggest players, but also right. the medium and small size players. So we'd like to see that as an initiative that the Economic Development Corporation and DCLA starts. So we think about new income streams for creatives in New York City so that they can make more, so that they can afford this, you know, the expenses of being in New York.
My concern is about the small groups, because the small groups are really struggling. Many of them are going under or about to go under. And the bureaucracy of the city, it doesn't matter who the mayor is, it's just overwhelming. So how can we cut through all of that? I made a suggestion when you were developing your study about creating public art districts that would not require any legislature, but then it would just rely on the cooperation of different agencies coming together, very similar to what DOT does with weekend walks in their summer streets, where they basically talk to the police, to community boards, SAPL, so therefore we can have more spaces. Do you see that possibly expanding in New York City for small groups who are desperately in need of spaces?
Yeah, I think your focus on small organizations is absolutely critical and absolutely correct. Especially we saw in immigrant communities that there are a lot of institutions that aren't even formally nonprofits, because getting nonprofit status is very difficult. And you can only get grants from government, from foundations, from private organizations, private individuals often if you are a nonprofit, because of tax deductibility and so many other reasons. So making it easier to become a nonprofit, making it easier to fill out these very complicated grant forms, which should become more and more complex, you know, at the city, foundation, state, federal level. That's something we highlighted as well. So that's really important, getting money to these kind of smaller organizations. Right now, we're seeing government funding decline. Mm-hmm. Federal and state level, city level has been pretty flat, except the capital budget, which actually has expanded significantly. But because these government institutions are falling, people are more dependent on private philanthropy. But who has the ability to reach out to private philanthropy, to throw big galas, to have these big development departments? It's often the larger institutions. So they're disproportionately benefiting from this change in the kind of philanthropy ecosystem. So it's really important that we think about small institutions and how they're being hurt by this kind of evolution and how we can help them, whether it's shared back office services, so shared technology services between small institutions, or shared development departments between small institutions, or easier time filling out grants, or easier access to the public domain, making permitting much easier. And because, as you're saying, it's extremely complex in New York City. So yeah, creating space, creating easier time getting grants, focusing on these small and medium-sized institutions is so critical in New York.
All right. And but you still didn't kind of answer that question in the sense of, do you see this actually expanding some of these ideas, these creative ideas like public art districts or more temporary plazas? Because I just feel that these are great spaces that can be for artists and not just local New York City artists, but guest artists as well. So therefore, we can have a vibrant New York City art scene, because it's kind of dwindling because it's all housed in museums or galleries, but it's just not a part of everyday life. So how do we enhance this so it can be a part of everyday life? Because the other flip side is, for many of these large institutions, their patrons are starting to die off. And they're looking for new people. And by ignoring the masses, they can't seem to get people interested in the arts. They still think it's highbrow. Mm-hmm. They don't think it's for everybody. And then they don't see the diversity that should be there, because New York is now the majority of minorities, people who are brown and black, not necessarily those who are Caucasian. So are we moving in some positive direction? Mm-hmm. Because I'm leery of it myself.
Yeah, I guess take on both questions there. So first, in terms of public space, It's so critical to program in public spaces to provide opportunities for local artists to present, to provide arts not just in Midtown Manhattan, but throughout the city is so critical. And there was actually an expansion of new parks and new public plazas during the Bloomberg administration through the DOT, through the Department of Parks. And I think it's we can't just build them. We need to program them as well. So making it easier to perform there and also having grants either through business improvement districts or some type of plaza stewards where they have funding to finance programming within those plazas, whether it's in Queens Diversity Plaza or Times Square. It's so critical that we're thinking about programming these facilities so that they are active and exciting spaces. So that's really important. And in terms of the diversity issue brought up, that was a really important concern in our report. So 67% of New York City residents are non-white, but only 29% of employees in the creative sector. Of actually people, not just people working on the back end of creative firms, but actual people in occupations who are working creative occupations, only 29% are non-white. So that's a really big issue. That's a really huge gap. And we need to think about why that is. And I think a lot of the cases are people more than ever have to get BFAs and MFAs in order to succeed in the arts, and that's extremely expensive. That's hundreds of thousand dollars of debt. There's a lot of unpaid internships more than ever with the profusion of nonprofits and dwindling government expenses. People need to, in order to have development staff, they often need to have unpaid labor. So unpaid labor, high debt, high affordability, and who can afford to be an artist? Only people of privileged backgrounds. And when that's the case, there's no, it's not a surprise that we have a real diversity gap. So whether it's city government giving money to nonprofits to pay interns, to making sure that all people are employed, to trying to defray the costs of graduate school by encouraging more people to go to CUNY programs or having a work study program in the city, we think all these are really important solutions. We need to lower the barriers to enter the arts so that a more diverse creative sector can exist.
I would say that some of these institutions, the easiest way to bring about diversity is just to work with groups that are outside of their normal circle. Even when I reach out to various groups, they just don't reply oftentimes because they just don't think we fit their program. And what does that mean exactly? So I think if some of these larger institutions were to be a little bit more neighborly, they just might find out that they would get some, diversity and a lot of fun. So we're going to wrap up this first segment and we'll come back where we're going to talk with Tim Tompkins and Sherry Dobins from Times Square Alliance.
And actually, Savannah, could you give folks a little more information about Adam and how they can contact Adam and find out more about this study?
So Adam Foreman is the author of Creative New York for the Center for an Urban Future, and I believe your site is CUF.org, correct?
NYCfuture.org.
NYCfuture.org. And you can download, I believe, the study from the site, and it's free, and you can read about it. It's a good read, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
And you're tuned to a cultural special here on WBAI, running till 3 p.m. Our guest host, Savannah Bailey of West Harlem Arts Fund. We are in the midst of discussing state of the arts in New York City. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
We are back for State of the Arts. This is Savannah Bailey McLean, your host for your show. Our next segment, we are going to be talking to Tim Tompkins, president of the Times Square Alliance, and Sherry Dobin, who is the director of public arts for Times Square Alliance. So I would like to thank both of them for coming on to the show. Tim, let's start talking about the pedestrian plaza and what was the motive behind its creation.
Really, it was started because there were so many people in Times Square once it became successful, but there wasn't enough space for them. So we found that 96% of the people who worked in Times Square were literally walking in the bed of the street because there wasn't enough space for them. And so it really grew out of that problem of Times Square success and how many people were in Times Square and just the need for more space. What it, of course, opened up was the opportunity not just to solve that pedestrian problem, but the opportunity to have this amazing space for cultural and civic activities.
So you're saying that art was an integral part of the planning of the plaza from the beginning?
It wasn't the impetus initially, but we had a nascent public art program, and with the creation of the plazas, it's really been able to blossom, and it's still an unfinished story because, of course, the plazas are still being constructed right now. But with Sherry Dobbin, our creative director and director of the public art program, we're fashioning a vision and a plan for how it becomes that kind of cultural space that reflects all of the diversity and richness of New York City and provides a platform for lesser heard, lesser known voices.
Okay. So then, Sherry, please tell us the impact of the programming that has taken place so far in the plaza.
Yes, what we've done is we've looked at all the sort of resources that we have in Times Square. We have the plazas, we have the electronic billboards at the gracious donation of the Times Square Advertising Coalition to program nightly. And then also we've programmed in different venues and odd spaces around the district, and we're also looking how we get into the digital and sort of online platform that we're going to start creating more content that way. The impact is that the people who are coming there anyway have the opportunity to experience something that they may not see anywhere else. They come wanting to be surprised and intrigued, and contemporary artists are the perfect people to do that. And then for the New Yorkers, it's really great for them to constantly play with what is their identity or memory of Times Square, and that can constantly be shifted. And one of the things we looked at is if you want to bring New Yorkers to Times Square, bring what New Yorkers already do and go to see and bring it into Times Square.
So I like the fact that you're saying that the plaza is still evolving, because as a curator, it's very hard sometimes to explain to the public that the arts is a process. They think it's instant, that you automatically have this idea and it can magically appear when that's not the case. So with that said, I want to talk about the controversy about the plaza, because I think a lot of people don't understand what's happened recently with the Elmo characters and the other panhandlers that are besieging the plaza and the naked ladies. So explain to us, you know, a little bit about that situation and what we can learn from that situation, because it's not just that these things are happening, but there's something that's being said about that space and why those people are coming there. Tim?
I think the nature of the problem has been distorted and overblown. There's really a small number of people. Times Square has always been a place of creative expression, spontaneity, and we want it to stay that way. We want it to be a public forum where there's freedom of expression and creativity in all forms. What happened was there's a small group of people, and it grew over the last couple years, who were being very aggressive and kind of shaking people down, especially tourists, but also, the first time I heard about this program was when someone in my office said, "Elmo just grabbed my rear end," and a lot of people who work in Times Square were having really unpleasant experiences. And then, you know, in the recent months, there's been this focus on naked women that hasn't been our core issue. It's actually legal to be naked in New York City. So really, it's like you've spent so much time programming public spaces and parks and public spaces. You know, you do have to have an environment where people don't feel intimidated for you to be able to do the positive and creative programming. And our focus is just, let's have some tools for managing this negative behavior, pay some attention to it, and then let's continue to allow all of the energy and the diversity and creativity and artistic offerings of New York City to be in that space as well. So it's not necessarily an either or. It's really about having a manageable public space that can have all of these expressions of creativity out there. But if there's a consumer protection issue where somebody's getting ripped off, you deal with it.
Okay. So, Sherry, I think that one of the biggest problems is that the public still doesn't understand the difference between fine arts and entertainment. And so therefore, they see it all as one. And they don't understand, you know, the thought that goes behind developing the arts. They just, you know, they just magically see this thing coming up. And people's impressions about the arts is that, oh, you know, it's frivolous, the arts. It's an afterthought. It's not a part, it's not an important part of a person's daily life. Is that what, you know, one of the problems that you see, or maybe there's new strategies that we need to develop?
I think what you're saying is very important, which is that you can't just put something out there. You have to think about how you put it out there. How do you frame it? How can someone have the certain signals that represent that there is something special happening? So whenever we put something in the plaza, we consider exactly how we frame it. Where do we physically put the posters? How do we think that people are going to anticipate it? How are they going to know that it's something different, that it's something purposeful, and that it's something of quality? The other thing is quality is just important. It doesn't matter. We've worked with artists who are 22 years old. We've worked with artists who are 80 and everywhere in between. The important thing is the quality of the idea, the appropriateness to that space, its relationship, the time of day you do it, who's going to encounter it, and if it's of a high quality. That can come from anyone. It can come from someone who has a degree. It can come from someone who's self-taught. Doesn't matter. But you always have to keep that as an important part of it. And also how you show respect to the work. If you put it out there and you have space around it and proper seating and you do it with the right audio support and whatever it requires, then other people will engage with it that way. And they will stop and say, oh, what is that? And then they'll encounter it. So we've had several people who have said to me, well, I know that's not yours because it wouldn't look like that. Mm-hmm. So there are ways that people will know if it's something that you're purposely putting out there, if everything you put out there is done with consideration and purpose. And that's one of the important factors that everyone knows who curates in public space, that you need to consider that people in galleries and theaters don't necessarily have to think about because their frame is already set.
Mm. I also am concerned about the fact that when we have a new administration, it feels like we're taking two steps forward and then three steps back. I like to say four steps back. And the issue of quality of life is important. And I'm starting to feel that one of the problems with this whole controversy is that we have some folks in administrations that don't understand the need for quality of life for everybody. And so I wanted to talk to you about that too, Tim, because when I heard the police commissioner say, oh, let's just tear it up now, I was aghast. Because it was like, well, don't we all deserve a quality of life? This is a stressful city. Don't we need that? Do you feel that's one of the issues?
I think you raise a very important point, which in fact matches much of the framing that of the de Blasio administration, which is the importance of equity. Times Square was the best known of these pedestrian plazas. But there are about 70 of them now throughout the city in every neighborhood, and each one of them has the potential to be a focal point for cultural and civic energy. And so it's important that we, just as we don't give up on Times Square, that we don't give up on the other ones. And yes, first and foremost, one has to pay attention to the quality of the spaces so that a family feels comfortable or anyone feels comfortable going into that space. And secondarily, how do you prime the pump? And this gets to your resource issue before. We're lucky and in Times Square, we can secure sponsorships and get the resources to do things. A very important aspect of the pedestrian plaza program is that it is in all neighborhoods, and part of what both government and the philanthropic community has to do is give additional resources for the partners that are managing and programming those plazas who don't have the kind of resources that a place like Times Square does. And I think that there's been a very accurate and good framing of that issue by the administration, and I think we're all looking forward to how that becomes realized.
Mm. All right, because I see that. I mean, I also participate in a pop-up plaza program, and this year I never had so many problems with the police. It was unbelievable because they wanted to see that Disney-like effect, and it was like, but why? Because they wanted us to solve a social problem in the area. And it was like, that's not our job. Our job is to make this plaza feel like an everyday experience, that people can see art and they can interact with each other and they can have conversation. And it doesn't have to be a crowd and it doesn't have to be a mob. And it doesn't require face painting and balloons and those bungee things that the children like to do. That's all I call them, the bungee things. So you can have this quality of life. And I just feel that sometimes that circus site experience actually fuels more, you know, this sort of craziness that people need to release. So it's good to hear that you're saying that you're encouraging the philanthropy community to perhaps give more to these plazas because they desperately are needed. So I think we still have room for another question. Okay, great. So I was going to ask Sherry a little bit of something too about the billboards. How did that program transpire? Because that too offers a great space for artists in New York City.
Yeah, it's wonderful. The billboards are all individually owned and operated. So it's an incredible collaboration between those sign holders and those programmers through the Times Square Advertising Coalition to agree to give up the same time for programming every night. So the last 3 minutes of every evening is a countdown to midnight in Times Square. And 363 or 364 days of the year, the artist gets to interpret that. And then one day over it becomes New Year's Eve. It's a great opportunity for people to be realizing that you don't have to be sold something. There are usually no advertisements that last for a 3 minute segment. So people start to look and wonder and ask, what is that? And it's a real wonderful release for people to be able to have those pauses or those opportunities in which you can be in one of the most vibrant commercial areas of the city and just enjoy something. Just take it in. Just watch the atmosphere change. Just understand that you feel like you're in a completely different place. When Yoko Ono did her piece in December of 2012, it was blue sky and white fluffy clouds in the middle of December at midnight. And that feeling of you could just be transported to a completely different season and place for a short period of time brings back a lot of that magic that people always associate with Times Square. But it's an incredibly collaborative process, and it's very interesting for the artists also to work with all of those kind of parameters of the different types of architecture and understanding a two-dimensional medium and a three-dimensional space. So it's been a really exciting challenge for everybody who's been involved, and we've really watched our partners open up more and more as to the kind of content that can be interpreted and the type of artists who actually get to use that platform.
Now, how would artists be able to at least apply for that program?
Sure. One of the things through our website, timessquarenyc.org/arts, there is an open proposal process throughout the year. So at any point, you can put forward your best idea through the proposal. We set it up so it's very simple. It's like a questionnaire. If you can answer those questions and put up, you know, your sample work, then it can be considered. It's not a fancy thing that you need to go through 18 workshops to figure out how to do.
Refreshing.
It's really like we ask you the question so you can answer it. If you can't answer it, you're not ready yet. But you could be 20 years old and have all the answers to that and know it and be able to put it up. You could be 54 and had 18, you know, retrospectives and still not be able to answer the question about your project. You're not ready. So it is one of the ways that we, you know, again, democratize the opportunity. It's all about the quality of the idea, the thinking, and how you want to engage with that space.
Thank you for saying that last part, because I deal with a lot of artists, and they don't understand that these are basics, having your statement, your bio, thinking through your idea, and it really enhances their practice. And so they get frustrated, but really it's for their own benefit. And I think the public needs to know that too. Because the public, again, doesn't realize all the work that goes behind the scenes. So I wish to thank you both for participating in this. This was really great. Thank you so much. And if there was anything you wanted to share to the mayor, what would you like to tell him now? I know.
We've been talking a lot about what we don't want to see in our public spaces. Let's now start the conversation about what's our vision and our aspiration of what we do want to see. And not just Times Square, but in every public space in New York City.
Thank you so very, very much. So we're going to break now, and then we're going to bring on Neil Gallagardi from New York City Department of Transportation to talk about some other new spaces that might pop up in the city.
And you're listening to a cultural special here on WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, coming at you from New York, covering the entire tri-state area. This is State of the Arts in NYC with your host, Savannah Bailey. Her guests, Sherry Dobbin and Tim Tompkins from Times Square Arts and Plants. Thank you.
Hello, we are back with State of the Arts. This is a cultural special on WBAI. I am Savannah Bailey-McLean, your host for today. And so far, we have been talking with some great guests about where the arts are in New York City. We started with Adam Foreman, who is the author of the study Creative New York by Center for an Urban Future. And we discussed with Adam, you know, what has been the progress when it's come to the arts in New York City. He feels that there have been some great strides where the arts has exploded in New York City, but then we also have some serious challenges, and that is affordability, income levels, when you compare it to the cost of living, kind of puts New Yorkers who are in the creative industry at a disadvantage and has stressed them to the breaking point. And then we talked about what can be done. So one of the things we talked about was, you know, the infrastructure of more space. And then we went on to talk with Tim Tompkins and Sherry Dobin from Times Square Alliance about their pedestrian plaza. That was the jewel of the Bloomberg's administration for creating these plazas. And now it's being threatened because you have folks who just don't seem to understand the importance of the arts and how they play a role in these public spaces. So now we're going to talk with Neil Gallagardi, who is the Director of Design for New York City Department of Transportation. And the reason we brought Neil here is because his agency, along with Design Trust, collaborated on a study called Under the Elevated, and how we possibly may have as much as 700 square miles.
Linear square miles of elevated structures in the city.
Okay.
And it's actually 666, but...
Oh, that's good.
That's an ominous number, so we don't really talk about that.
So we may have close to 700 square miles of underutilized spaces. And considering the controversy about the Times Square pedestrian plaza, members of the de Blasio administration is trying to find more space and more plaza space. So I wanted first for Neil to explain that study, how it came about. And, you know, more details about what we might be able to do to expand that program.
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, the Design Trust for Public Space approached DOT and the unit in urban design with a proposal to partner with them on this study. As many know, the Design Trust really is an incubator of ideas. They kind of spark the idea of the High Line that kind of grew into what we know as the High Line. They also did work with the Times Square Alliance way back before the project was being planned to really inspire an idea of that space. So we gladly agreed to do this. And for the past 2 years, we really have been working very intensely with the Design Trust and their fellows. They had three, four fellows working on this, really taking a comprehensive inventory of all the space in and around elevated infrastructure around the city. I think what's significant about it is that it's the first time that we've ever taken an inventory comprehensively. There have been one-offs like the High Line, like space under the Queens Plaza in Long Island City, but this is the first time we've really looked at this space as an asset for the city. What is it? What does it mean for the city's future? What's its potential for public space in most in a lot of underserved neighborhoods, as well as, you know, what other uses does it proffer for the city and its functions? It culminated this summer in a publication, Under the Elevated, which really lays out a lot of the precedents we studied, a lot of the case studies that we looked at in particular, and presents some design proposals for that, and also highlights two of the main installations we pursued last summer, one on Division Street under the Manhattan Bridge in Chinatown, Manhattan, and one at Southern Boulevard in the Bronx at Freeman Street.
I have a little story about Freeman Street. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And so my grandmother would take me and my sister every year before school, at least in elementary school. And we used to go there because there used to be a lot of merchants on Freeman Street. a lot of dress shops.
Yeah.
So every year before school, and then at that time, I'm dating myself, in New York City, girls could not wear pants. You had to wear dresses.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go there every year so that we would be like the queen for a day and just try on different dresses that she prepaid these merchants so that we could go and pick out our dresses. That kind of activity is kind of gone now on Freeman Street, but I remember that very much. But dealing with that, talking about activities, did you see, in addition to just creating, you know, plazas, how would it impact economically? Because I think sometimes people don't see the economic impact that the arts can bring for retailers.
Yeah. Well, that's a significant point. I love that story. I mean, the whole focus of that effort was really to activate the space. I mean, it actually is an area where one of our DOT programs called Bus Stops Under the L, where we expanded the sidewalk a couple of years prior. So it afforded the space for it. But one of the main aspects of the installations and the program development is really engaging in the community. And fellow Chet Trevisio, who was working integrally in this project, partnered with WEDCO, Women's Housing Economic Development Corporation, which is doing fantastic work for housing development in the area and really transforming it. And I think they really saw this as a great opportunity to really make contact to the community, its history. And this particular element was called Boogie Down Booth. So, and it was curated by the Bronx Academy of Music, which was nearby. And I think you know, there were multiple facets, you know, from a DOT perspective and from an urban design perspective. We were using it to test a number of things. What works? Can we put lighting? There were no seats there. How do we activate the space? How do we provide amenity for pedestrians as well as residents? So there were a lot of things that we were watching just from a very urban design standpoint. But the engagement and the curation of the Bronx Academy of Music really imbued it with meaning, and it was really hearkening back to the history of the Bronx and its musical legacy. And interestingly enough, that was in a part of the whole design. So when people were sitting beneath the element and the lights, they would hear the curated music. And one of the things is for elevated structures is the noise.
Yes,
it's so you know, in many locations unbearable, and it's one of the things we're trying to mitigate and really address. But here was a way of taking a curated legacy element and try, in an effort to mitigate noise, at least when people were sitting underneath, and it was really effective. The booth also had lighting, which is another element that we're really trying to explore. Everyone complains about the darkness, the hulking nature of these structures, no matter what they look like. So it was a great opportunity, and we're actually going to do some demonstration where we're building on that effort to see if we can replicate it in other forms and put it in other areas in the Bronx and elsewhere in the city.
Yes, I have to comment because last year under the 12th Avenue Viaduct, we had the H in Harlem, for which I was the curator. And
Savannah, can you tell people a little bit more about the H project?
Yeah.
Visualize it for folks.
Sure. So what happened was I was on the local community board for many years. And then I had retired from it. But one of the concerns was how do we activate the new waterfront that we had? And the viaduct or the L for the IRT, number one train on Broadway, the city had decided that they were going to put lights there. It hasn't started yet, but it was really an intriguing project where they're going to put the lights so when the trains go across, it would look like a bolt of lightning. Mm-hmm. And every single time we had a test, it was in the middle of winter. I always complained about that with EDC. I said, why am I freezing here? So anyway, when it came down, it always was. I never understood that. So then when we were dealing with the 12th Avenue side, there was a concern about the integrity of the viaduct, that nothing would be placed on it so that it could buckle.
Yeah.
And so we went through this 2-year process, and at the end of the process, the city said, we have no money. I said, you have no money? What do you mean? You put me through this 2-year process and you have no money. So it was funny. I saw an article in AM New York, and I saw this artist that was listed there. And I said, this person looks like they would be good for this project. So I contacted my buddy at EDC who was working on it. And I said, you know, I think we should contact this artist so we could deal with this. And he said, no, Savannah, let's just focus on the streetscaping part, which is still 5 years behind schedule. But it started. And then eventually he kept saying, no, let's just focus on that. And I reached out to the artist. And I asked him, he's really a lighting designer. And I said, would you be willing to help? And he offered. And that's how the H in Harlem started. What was supposed to be a project that could have been put up in 3 months took over a year. But nonetheless, when it did finally go up, it was stunning.
Yeah.
With LED lights. And now the whole entire city is looking towards putting up LED lights. And so, and it was a very expensive project, but, and glorious too. But that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, you know.
Which was a large H.
It was a large H in oval you can see aluminum truss. And right. You can see it online. When you do see it online, just Google the H in Harlem. It's stunning. Mm-hmm. It's drop dead gorgeous. Your mouth just simply drops. And the artist, Bentley Meeker, actually built a site that was recommended to him by me so that people could see how it was developed, how it was actually put together. People like that. So my point is for saying all of this, because the viaduct was mentioned in the study, that more of this is kind of needed, but it is expensive.
Yeah.
And how do we maybe engage the lighting design community who could really help so we can have more replications of these types of installations?
Well, that's exactly what we're aiming this study and this effort to do. I mean, again, that was a great effort. That was really significant for I worked on the streetscape project, which is not yet built completely. But, you know, it was at the terminus of a major street in Manhattan, and you know, the treatments were significant there, and the H just was the icing on the cake. But they tend to be one-offs in the city, and that's what we're trying not to do. Again, if we say there are 700 linear miles of this in many neighborhoods, we have to find ways to facilitate this and expedite this treatment, you know, more quickly, less expensively, and maintenance is a major issue too. So the whole focus of the study and the program that we're developing is really trying to address that. So we are engaging with a lighting designer, Linnea Tillett Lighting Design, to kind of look at that example and other precedents and see how can we systematize, how can we perceptually address some of the lighting of these structures, and how can we make it affordable, how can we make it maintainable, and frankly even acceptable to, you know, our own divisions in our own agency, which, you know, is managing thousands upon thousands of lights throughout the city. So I think we don't want these to be one-offs, and we can replicate it elsewhere and also address the context of the community. And I think that's what the Boogie Down Booth was. What was significant about the Boogie Down Booth, the problem set was don't touch anything. Because one of the things, and I worked on a project at Queens Plaza where there were a lot of great ideas, but you know, they were poo-pooed a lot because of it was about attaching onto structures.
Yes.
And the problem set is Southern Boulevard is don't. My aunt used to tell me that when I was in her apartment. Don't touch anything when I was a child. And we didn't. And the piece just fit around the column. And we got a sign off from the engineers at MTA within hours. They were on site. So these are the kind of things we want to really do.
Okay.
Work within the parameters of, you know, engineering and some of the provisions we have to all work within and see how we can really activate the space and expedite it.
Great. Well, one thing I would like for DOT to look at more is digital projections because that's more prevalent in Europe.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why it's such a problem here in the U.S.
Well, you know, we're launching other pilots in the city, one being at 36th Street and 3rd Avenue in Sunset Park at Industry City. And one of the things is trying to see, like, what are the projections that we can use? There are some traffic provisions when it's across the street, and we have to understand that, even just for our own agency. What can and what can we not do and work within that parameter? But I think, you know, that was successful in the projections on the Dumbo Arch in Dumbo on the Manhattan Bridge. And I mean, those are spectacular example. So I agree with you. We should look at that more.
All right. Well, thank you so much, sure. Neil, for coming on this program.
Thank you for having me.
And, Neil, how do people find out more about these projects that DOT yeah. are up to and collaborate for artists?
Yeah. We just launched our publication, and we're in the mm-hmm. throes of our pilots. I would suggest actually going to the Design Trust for Public Space website. I think it's designtrust.org. They are soliciting applications for new fellows for the pilot in Sunset Park. That really does explain a lot of the program and efforts, and it tells you where you can get the publication. We are still working on our own website at DOT and hope to have that up. There's an email address, lspace@dot.nyc.gov, where communities or interested parties could email and inquire about certain spaces and how they might participate.
Great, thanks.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And we're here with Savannah Bailey, your host for a cultural special here on WBAI, taking you to the top of the hour, State of the Arts in NYC. Stay tuned.
We're back. This is State of the Arts, hosted by Savannah Bailey McLean. And our next guest is Shirazad Garcia, who's a Brooklyn-based artist. And Shirazad is going to share with us a little bit of some of the experiences that artists, live through when they're trying to produce art throughout the city, whether in galleries or alternative spaces or public art. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask Shirazad Garcia, what are some of the constraints that she individually experienced when she's trying to produce art?
One of the many things that usually happens, and thank you, Savannah, for inviting me. Mm-hmm. This is one of those conversations we usually have. It's when we are trying to invent and create all these projects. But definitely, one of the things that I think about is to deal with the bureaucracy.
Yes.
Of the city. And it's almost impossible to break that frontier. Nevertheless, artists, we are warriors. So we always find a way. But also then, so many times, they realize, many of the people that are involved in these ideas, that yes, you activate these areas, you inject certain areas of the city with such energy. And it is unbelievable how it changed the areas. For example, let's even think about one of those projects we did together at St. Nicholas Park. Mm-hmm. It was something that it was like two sides of that story. We were able to deal with the bureaucracy. We were able to build the project house as we wanted, but we definitely dealt with the problem of money.
Yes.
You know, budget. You know, how come we had to do all these wonderful things and we don't make any money?
Right.
And then all these people capitalize on it and everybody forgets about the artist.
Yes.
But then is that part of the artist that we cannot escape? It's like how much is, so how fulfilling it is to see how these areas become the place for people to go to have a picnic. How people start really using these spaces. And then how you as an artist can also engage in the community. So then it's like all these, it's such an acrobatic act because there are so many good things and very bad things.
I'm so glad you said that, talking about the energy, because a lot of times people don't realize what we actually give as creative professionals. It's not about the 15 minutes worth of fame. It is actually the realization of ideas coming together and being placed just right in the right moment so that everyone can enjoy it. And with that said, one of my pet peeves, and I'm hoping that we could get some resolution on this, is more collaborations. And I know people say that all the time, but talking about bureaucracies, I was stunned when 2 years ago I was trying to work on a project in the Bronx with an artist who originally was from the Bronx as well. I was born and raised in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't do it with the venue because they said it was a cross-county collaboration. And we were like, what? What is that? So they were basically saying that even though we were told we had the best project when we submitted it, that it could only be Bronx-based artists. And we were saying, but wouldn't it be great for those who used to live in the Bronx who wanted to give back to their community an opportunity to do so? And wouldn't that be inspiring and encourage other people to want to do this? And we were told no. So I find that as a challenge for artists where there's no real New York scene because it has to be only Bronx-based or Brooklyn-based or Queens-based. And there's no real synergy being developed with artists, considering how expensive rents are, and it's tough for everyone to get together in the first place. Do you share the same frustration?
As a matter of fact, it's great that you, you know, talking about this, because I do feel it's such a very anti-New York attitude. And all the things that happen to us, and, you know, we keep talking about this, and it's, but it's because it's so true. I mean, New York is full of people that come from other places. But you do become New Yorker. You know, we all, you know, I am sure we all feel the same. I mean, I am born in the Dominican Republic. I was born in the Dominican Republic, but I do feel like I'm a New Yorker. And every time we engage in these projects, to be able to reach the audience, you had to delve into the history of these places. Mm-hmm. So then there is no excuse for us to talk about like, oh, you cannot do that because you come from Manhattan or you come from Staten Island. No, it's still New York. It's still an artist as a universal voice, in my opinion. So I wonder how can we solve that? I think education.
Or go rogue.
Would you say Banksy? Banksy is an example.
I think we might need to do that. Kind of bend some of these rules around here.
Yeah, uno todos. Yes.
Well, I want to thank you, Shirazad, for coming on the show. This was really, really great because we had some good people from different vantage points, from different backgrounds and perspectives and offices coming together, expressing their same frustration. Maybe now we can all come together a little bit more and really make New York the true art capital of the world. Right now it's Berlin, but let's bring it back to New York.
And you've been listening to State of the Arts, a cultural special here with your host, Savannah Bailey, on WBAI today, 2 to 3. You can catch this in the archives in greater detail if you missed any of it. And we will also be adding additional links to reach out to the various guests in our program highlights on the homepage shortly. And who are our lineup of guests today again, and where were they representing?
So we had Adam Foreman from Center for an Urban Future, Tim Tompkins, president of Times Square Alliance, and Sherry Dobin, who is their creative director and director for public art. We also had Neil Gallagardi, director of design for New York City Department of Transportation, and Shirazad Garcia, Brooklyn-based artist.
Thank you so much, Savannah, for joining us here. And we are looking forward to more from Ms. Savannah Bailey. Check out more on Savannah and the work that she does by going to WestHarlemArtsFund.org. And you have an upcoming event, Savannah.
Oh, no. It's West Harlem Art Fund.
Oh, sorry. West Harlem Arts Fund.
No, Art Fund.
Art Fund, singular.
WordPress.com.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
And your event coming up, we have posted as well in the highlights right now. Join in October 3rd
under the Viaduct in West Harlem on 12th Avenue.
All right. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.
Thanks.